You may proceed.
Good morning. To please the court, my name is Sid Kirstein, and I'm here representing Ms. Henderson in this appeal against the rulings of the trial court below.
Before you get too far into that argument, I want to ask you a few questions about the status of the case before the court.
Yes, sir.
Rule 517 forbids changing the assignments of error after the writ has been granted, and the enforcement of that has been widespread, particularly in the case of Hamilton Development Company versus Broad Rock Club Incorporated. In your petition for appeal, you have five assignments of error, four and five, for reasons that you decided to do, which is fine, are not even addressed in the opening brief. So they're waived, would seem to me. But one, two, and three from the petition for appeal have morphed into a different assignment of error in its text, particularly three. So what we're faced with is that the court heard in a writ panel your petition for appeal, granted what you said was your appeal on the assignments of error that you actually dictated, and then you briefed a completely different case for the most part. What do we do with this?
Judge Lemons, I don't think we briefed a different case.
You changed the language of your assignments of error.
Well.
And particularly with number three, the number three in the opening brief is a different issue than the number three in the petition for appeal.
I don't read it that way. I understand what you're saying. I understand my opponents made that point. Four and five were mooted based upon the rulings of the court. There were two appeals that came up. One of the appeals was dismissed for being untimely notice. That was number four. Then number five, you accepted the written statement of facts, so it didn't have to be remanded back for the trial. So with respect to number three in the opening brief, if the court would review in the petition of assignments number two and number three, number two in the petition, basically said the procedures below deprive the beneficiaries of any meaningful opportunity to challenge the rulings of the court. And number three in the petition stated that this procedure resulted in the trial court not considering the double billings that occurred in the $62,000 of billings that were submitted on the same day that this matter was presented. And those two were then merged, and I agree it's worded a little different. They were merged into what's currently number three in the opening brief.
All of that flies in the face of the 517 that says only what has been granted by the court is going to be the subject of the appeal. And the case law, particularly Hamilton Development Company, says you shall not change your assignments of error after the court has granted them. What authority do you have for doing all the things that you're saying you're doing?
Well, Judge, the court has also said that if there are no substantive changes, so that the exact same issues are now being presented in the opening brief as the exact same issues that were being presented in the petition, even though there may be some rewording or some merging, as I have done in this matter, which I did out of my thought that this would be more simplified and presented in a better way to this court. But this court has repeatedly said if there are no substantive changes, that does not default the matter. And we've outlined that in our reply brief, that there's been no substantive changes, and therefore we take the position that it's not been defaulted, and it's properly before the court. The exact same issues raised in numbers 1, 2, and 3 in the petition are now being raised in numbers 1, 2, and 3 in the opening brief.
Okay, so let's look at what appears to be some substantive changes.
Yes, sir.
Your original argument was that the circuit court had delegated its authority, and that was your first granted assignment. You're now arguing that the circuit court actually approved the accountings but then referred them back to the commissioner by order, quote, empowering the commissioner to enter a final order approving the accountings. But the commissioner did not enter an order of approval. It only submitted the reports to the court. So that appears to be a substantive change.
I didn't follow you exactly because I was looking and you were speaking, and I'm sorry.
Your original argument was that the circuit court had delegated its authority, which was the crux of that first assignment of error.
Yes, sir.
And now you're arguing that the court actually approved the accountings but then referred them back to the commissioner, empowering the commissioner to enter a final order approving the accountings. You're saying that's not substantive?
I'm saying that in the assignments of error, which is page 302 of the appendix, I said the circuit court, number one, accepted a direct submittal of the fiduciary seventh and final accountings for the Nugent Living Trust and estate. That's raised in number one of the brief. Circuit court erred by accepting a direct submittal.
I actually had to do a red line to figure out your original from your amended. You can see all that red. Let's ignore the bottom. It's just the list of substantive changes. That's what the red line looks like.
I don't think there's substantive changes. I think that's it's worded number one.
Let's look at then the third assignment of error, which introduced the notion of, quote, customary statutory review procedures, end quote, that wasn't ever referenced in any of the original assignments of error.
I'm not following again. The assignment of error in the petition said that circuit court's procedural error is called to error by substantively awarding Ms. Cook legal fees for performing non-legal administrative duties. We on the same, reading the same one?
I'm reading it.
All right, and then if you look over on L number three, that the circuit court's failure to require the trustee to submit her accountings to the customary steps would deprive the residuary beneficiaries of their due process rights to examine and challenge propriety. So we are saying the same thing, I think, in numbers two and number three are incorporated in my current number three, and number one was divided from the petitions, divided into number one and number two. Number one in the petition stated that we accepted a direct submittal of the seventh and final accountings. Number one in the brief says that it was error to accept a direct submittal of the seventh and final accountings. Number second part of the assignment, number one, the petition was it was error to delegate to the commission the right to make a final unreviewable order. That now comes as number two in the opening brief, that the circuit court erred by approving then referring this matter back to the commissioner by an order purporting to empower the commissioner, not the court, to issue a final unreviewable order. Those seem to me, as my position, those are substantively exactly the same. There's no difference between those two. We just divided assignments of error in the petition, number one, into number one and number two, and then we combined number two and number three in the petition into the current number three.
Okay.
I guess you can see why it is we'd say you do not change your assignment of error, because we've been here now for just shy of 10 minutes trying to figure out what you did.
I appreciate everything you're telling me, and I have certainly taken it to heed. I apologize for rewriting it in any way, shape, or form. However, I don't think that Ms. Henderson should be penalized substantively when there's been no substantive change.
I think that the court may very well differ with you about whether there were substantive changes. But you've also, as a result of all of this, lost 10 minutes of your time. You may very well want to proceed with the
thank you, sir.
May I ask you this?
Yes, sir.
The estate's closed, right? And the assets have been distributed?
I think that's true.
So the principle that you don't need to file a supersedis bond, not waiving your right of appeal, is certainly true in the abstract. Because you can always get, between the parties, you can always get restitution after a favorable judgment on appeal, even in the absence of the supersedis bond. But here, correct me if I'm wrong, there are people who are not technically parties who have received some of the assets. Would restitution even apply there? And if not, wouldn't that render the case moot?
I believe that if the case was to go back, and I urge the court to send it back because we did not follow the proper statutory procedures in the first place, which it starts with the commission of counts, goes to the circuit court.
I'm with you on that, but the question is it moot?
I think the judge can order a refund from the trustee and the guardian if it's determined that the trustee was paid legal fees, which the trustee was not entitled to be paid, and that decision will be made after a more thorough evaluation, not a same-day review, but a more thorough evaluation of the charges that were made. Charges were made for legal bills for going to check on water leaks at homes that the guardian and custodian should have done as administrative fee.
Back from the trustee in his individual capacity, just the money's recouped back to the estate, and then that is distributed consistently with distribution plan. Is that your argument? It's not moot for that reason?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow you completely.
In a nutshell, the failure to file a supersedis bond is not fatal. I think you're right about that.
Yes, sir.
But it is fatal where the court is precluded from reconstituting the status quo. And you can always reconstitute it with the parties because they're sitting in front of you. You can just say, give it back. Give the two-bit back, whatever it is. But if it's not parties, if it's other beneficiaries that receive funds from an estate, the court would have no power to disgorge those. But you're telling me none of that would happen here because it's just the fees.
Correct. Ms. Cook was a party, remains a party, is a party, received fees as a party, and she could be required by the court to refund any amounts the court felt were improperly received in the first place. Certainly. The substance of this case is very clear. 64.2-1200 says, and the following provisions in that section, chapter 12 of that code section, that everything has to start with the commission of counts. You have to have hearings before the commission of counts. You've got a right to object to those matters. You've got a right, then the commission of counts issues a report. You've got a right to file exceptions to that report before the circuit court. Those exceptions have to be on file with the circuit court 15 days before the circuit court can take any action whatsoever. And after that point in time, there could be a jury trial involved, but at that point in time, the circuit court has to review all that and has to certify in its order that it's personally examined those exceptions that came from the commission's report. None of that happened in this case. It didn't happen because the judge was retiring December 31st, and the judge wanted to get this done in the same day. So this seventh and final canon was filed at 7:34 p.m. on December 26th, after work hours. It was brought to the courthouse the next morning at 10 o'clock, presented to the judge at 10 o'clock, and by 10:30, quarter of 11, it was done. There were no hearings. There was no chance to review these matters. There was no chance to consider any of this. $62,000 in legal fees and $13,000 in administrative fees were awarded without any meaningful opportunity to consider these matters, any meaningful opportunity for the judge to consider these matters. It was then sent back to the Commission of Accounts with an order said, whatever you say will be my final order. And upon you filing your report, which is my final order, the case is dismissed, the trust is ended, the trustee is relieved of any responsibilities, the clerk is directed to remove this matter from the docket.
Counsel, you may
yes,
end
ma'am.
Up with no rebuttal time. I anticipate, because it's in the brief, that opposing counsel is going to say that everything that you say is correct. The order was inverted, perhaps incorrectly, but as I understand the brief, they're going to say it's harmless error because the same accountings were placed before the court that were placed before the commissioner, and basically the same assignments of error or the same exceptions were made to the court that were made to the commissioner. And so their argument is everybody saw the same thing, everybody decided the same thing, so it really doesn't matter that it was perhaps inappropriately inverted. So help me with the harmless error.
Due process, the right to review things, the right to be heard, the right to cross-examine people, all of that is built into the procedures before the Commission of Accounts. All that's built into the provisions before the Circuit Court. We received none of that. You just can't file reports and say, well, the Commissioner saw the report, the Circuit Court saw the report, so all the reports are fine. No. The beneficiaries have a right to challenge those matters. The beneficiaries have a right to examine those matters. The beneficiaries are lay people. The commissioner is an attorney. The trustee is an attorney. The judge was an attorney. They have the legal minds, but the beneficiaries have a right to challenge these matters. They have a right to see them, have a day or two or three or 10, 15, according to the code, to review them and think about it, to engage people about what was really, why are you charging $210 an hour to go look at a water leak when that's something you're being paid administratively
to do? Okay, so anticipating the argument being you received them the night before the trial court's hearing, and so you had the benefit of the time before the commissioner's hearing to review them, and you could have challenged them there. Tell me why that.
And we did, and we asked for a hearing. No hearing was received. An order was entered by the commissioner, and the circuit court's order said when that commissioner files a report, that's the final report. And your appeal period ran from the time the commissioner filed his report, and the case was dismissed, and the trustee was relieved, and there was nothing, and the matter was removed from the clerk's docket so that nothing else could be done. The commissioner should have held hearings, and we might, if that had happened, that's speculation, if that had happened, maybe we wouldn't be where we are. But that's not what happened. There were no hearings held, no opportunity for that. I see my time is up. I'm glad
to
respond.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, madam.
May it please the court, good afternoon. I'm Monica Monday on behalf of Stephanie Cook in her official capacity as trustee and conservator for the estate. We do not believe that the court can reach the merits of the issues presented on appeal because there has either been waiver or any error is harmless. So I'll start with the assignments of error because I too spent some time trying to figure out what had happened, and I'll try to do my best to explain why the changes that were made were substantive and do allow Ms. Henderson to argue new and different issues on appeal. The change that has been made from the granted assignments of error to the new assignments of error is that the new assignments basically present a problem with the order in which things were done by the trial court. So if you look at the original one, you're just dealing with there was a direct submittal to the trial court.
Isn't that order, Ms. Monday? Isn't that challenging the order, the direct submittal?
It is not, Your Honor, because and what we did was at the petition stage, we pointed out the problem with this assignment of error. The direct submittal, there was not a direct submittal because, in fact, as Mr. Kirstein just stated, the trial court actually did send the accountings to the Commissioner of Accounts as he was required to do. So it did go to the Commissioner of Accounts, and the Commissioner of Accounts heard it. So we pointed that out, that was really a fallacy. The assignment of error was a fallacy because there wasn't a direct submittal.
Don't they go to the Commissioner of Accounts first and then to the court?
Well, correct. Right. But the trial court actually did have an opportunity to first consider it before it was referred.
Submittal is their way of saying it was out of order. You're saying
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if we look at what they did, so in the revised assignments of error, now the revised assignment of error number one ties the direct submittal to without requiring that the final Nugent accounting be first submitted to and ruled upon by the Commissioner of Accounts. That's completely new language. It's a completely new argument.
It's new language, but is the argument any different? I mean, to me, it says that it originally said that the court accepted a direct submittal from the fiduciary, and then they sent it to the Commissioner of Accounts. And in this next one, they're basically saying the same thing. The court erred by accepting a direct submittal and then sending it to the Commissioner of Accounts.
Yeah, but it doesn't talk. A direct submittal meant that it bypassed, it's sort of what you just heard, is that the direct submittal is it bypassed all the other procedures. And that's a fallacy because the accountings were reviewed and considered by the Commissioner. Objections were filed to those reports. So, in truth, there was no direct submittal, but also look at the revised assignment of error number two. Erred in approving them and referring them to the Commissioner of Accounts. And again, this isn't in any part of what was in the granted assignments of error. Now what the beneficiary is asking for is the proper order. That was not what was in the original assignment of error. There is also a problem with the due process assignment of error. The wording and meaning is different in this assignment of error as well. In the granted assignment of error number two, says lost the opportunity to challenge the fiduciary's billings. in the revised assignment of error number 3, lost the opportunity to challenge the legal and administrative fees sought by the fiduciary. Another problem in the granted
the
assignment...
The fiduciary's billings, excuse me, Ms. Mundy, but
yes.
Wouldn't the fiduciary's billings be the amount of the legal and administrative fees?
No, Your Honor. If in the joint appendix, you'll see that there are numerous pages of what the billings are. It is changing the nature of
billings, which then become the amount of legal and administrative fees, which the...
Not necessarily,
okay.
Your Honor. And it's certainly, I think that it's completely vague. And clearly, the original assignment of error, we believe, the due process assignment of error originally is drafted as vague. But then also we look here...
Can I stop you for a second, Ms. Mundy?
Yes, Your Honor.
I wonder if it might be more productive for you. We're going to look at the assignments of error as we approve them. And why don't you just knock down those dominoes as they're written, as opposed to trying to compare, well, he said, but then he said. And bottom line is, assignment of error 1, as it was approved, should we grant it or shouldn't? Should we, you know, reverse or whatever?
Well,
we rule on it.
I mean, in terms of, we think that there's a problem with the due process assignment of error even as granted.
Let me ask you this, Ms. The court's order says that the final accounting approved by the commissioner shall be the approval by the court, which appears on its face to wholly fail to grasp the role of the court's role under the statutory scheme. If that's error, and assume without conceding it is clear error, why don't we get to that point? And how can it be harmless error?
Sure. So in addition to the problems with the assignments of error, which we believe constitute a waiver on that part, we believe that any error to that has been waived because exceptions, what the order did not clearly provide for was the trial court's review of exceptions once they're filed, and that's governed by 64.2.12.12b. So once the exceptions were filed, I think that there was an issue with the order. But at that point, Ms. Henderson filed her exceptions to the commissioner's report. At that moment, those exceptions were still within the breast of the court. The 21 days had not run yet. So the order became final, and the clock started to run on March 20th when the commissioner issued his reports. Within 14 days later, the beneficiary files exceptions to the commissioner's report. At that moment, there's still a week of time where it's within the breast of the court. At no time did Ms. Henderson alert the court that these exceptions were filed and should be ruled on. Now, understanding that the order said that, you know, the commissioner's report is an approval.
And they had objected to that at the time. They said, don't do this, and you did it.
Correct. That's right. And so it was. So the process stopped there. And so instead of either, you know, you were still within the breast of the court, so did not alert the court that the exceptions had been filed and should be ruled on, because, and that's critical.
He'd lost that point.
Well, yes, but at the time that the final order was entered, Your Honor, no exceptions had been filed. No exceptions had been filed at that time.
Well, he got a ruling from the trial court. Don't bother me with it.
Well, he did. He did file exceptions, and we know, for example, the Reiner case. A counsel has an affirmative duty to alert the court if there is an objection pending that has not been ruled on. The court had not ruled on the exceptions. So there were various opportunities available at that time, and because it was still within the breast of the court, there was an opportunity.
But the court had already told him, I'm not going to rule on the exceptions. I'm not going to rule on anything. The final commissioner's report is my final. In other words, just don't even file what you want to file, but I'm not going to do anything. That's what I think he heard when he read that statement in the order. That's what I read when I saw the order.
Well, Your Honor, and I think we're talking about something very close, but still, the trial court had never ruled on the exceptions. It's unclear whether the trial court even, you know, knew that the exceptions were before the court. Now, the importance of this is because under 64.2.12.12a, if no exceptions had been filed, it would have been fine. That section actually says that if no exceptions had been filed, the report shall stand confirmed. So if no exceptions had been filed, there was no problem with the way that the order was drafted. So we believe that...
But that's circular, though, because the order precludes exceptions. The order says, I don't care whether you file exceptions or not. I'm not going to hear it. Whatever the commissioner says is me. He speaks for me, or she speaks for me.
Well, and even if there wasn't a waiver, Your Honor, because of the exceptions being filed, then what we have is we think we have harmless error. There were objections filed at every stage, and let me go back to when the final order was entered. So the hearing was held on December 27th of 2017, and at that time, the court issued the ruling from the bench and gave Ms. Henderson 2 additional days to file objections. Objections were filed, and the court actually reviewed and considered those objections before entering the final order. Then at that point, final order is entered. Then the reports, the accountings are filed with the Commissioner of Accounts, and then Ms. Henderson files objections with the Commissioner, which are considered and rejected. They are basically the same types of issues, the same issues you've heard today about the legal billings, that they were the same objections. Those were overruled and rejected. And then you've got the exceptions that are filed. So you have 3 sets of objections. The only thing that wasn't considered were the exceptions to the commissioner's report. And they really are all raising the same issue with one exception. Okay. And the one exception is the hearing. Right. Let's talk about the hearing. So I believe it is Joint Appendix page 195. There was no request in the objections that were sent to the commissioner. There was no request for a hearing. There was a request for a right to depose the trustee, but there was no request for a hearing. And this becomes very critical too, because then we get to the relief that is sought in this case. And the request for relief is remand for a hearing. There is no right as a matter of law to a hearing, either before the commissioner or before the trial court. Under 64.21212B, there are 3 different things that the trial court can do once it gets exceptions. It can impanel a jury, and this court has said that basically implies the right to a hearing, but there is no right as a matter of law to a hearing, because one of the other things that the court can do is confirm the report in whole or in part. So there is no right to a hearing. Now, I believe that...
Let me interject.
Yes, Justice Mintz.
If the judge on December 27th, I guess, had said, you know, and I've seen this estate before, I know these issues.
7 years.
I have to go to the Commissioner of Accounts. I'm entering a final order. Did he have the statutory authority to do that?
I think there is a problem with the way that order is drafted, Your Honor. I think that, and maybe this is where we get to the order of things. As a conceptual matter, really the trial court did heard what the issues were that day, had the case for 7 years, had the opportunity to understand exactly what had happened. The file is enormous. And so the trial court, and that was the judge who had presided over the entire case. Were things perhaps taken out of order? Maybe they were. But they were thoughtfully considered that day, and the judge had even considered the objections that were filed before entering the order.
Yeah, well, but here's my specific question. If the judge had said, because I know this case so well, I don't need the Commissioner of Accounts any longer. I'm just going to enter my final order right this minute. You got 21 days to note your exceptions for the appeal process. Did the judge have the statutory authority to do that, or was the judge statutorily required to send it back, to send it through the Commissioner of Accounts?
I believe that every fiduciary has to account to the Commissioner of Accounts. So I think that the recountings did have to be filed with the commissioner,
okay.
Which I think then triggers the statutory procedure.
All right.
But
the court can dispense with the commissioner, can't he, at will. I've got the final account. I'm looking at it myself. I see your objections. Overrule. Final order. Why does he have to send it back to the commissioner for anything if he doesn't want to?
Well, these accountings had not been approved by the commissioner. The reality is the court did not dispense with the commissioner because he was trying to provide due process to the beneficiaries in the case.
I know he didn't dispense with it. I'm just trying to figure out what he had the authority to do in terms of the potential harmless error.
The one thing
it's unclear to me at this point, because I think that the commissioner, I guess because he did refer it to the commissioner, so I'm struggling with your question, Your Honor.
That's okay.
The one thing it seems he did that he shouldn't have done is say, I'm going to refer it to the commissioner and I'm going to exercise no judicial review over it. Would you contest that?
I believe that he did exercise judicial review over it, Your Honor, by considering it at that time, and also by considering the same objections that were raised to the commissioner. So in essence, when it got, you know, if it had gotten back to the trial court, if there had been a hearing or some type of issue on the exceptions, the result likely would have been the same. And it would have been because the judge had already had an opportunity to thoughtfully review and consider the issues back at the time when the hearing was held on December 27th, and again, a matter that was before this court for 7 years.
But counsel, can we really know that it would have been the same had it started with the commissioner as I think the statute provides? There are these lengthy billings, and they're challenging things as significant as what was she charging attorney's fees when she should have been doing this in her fiduciary trustee capacity? Did she sit on the estate longer than she should have, thereby incurring additional charges? And so those are factual questions that at least they're arguing someone should have taken the time to go through these and evaluate them. And so it's coming top down, the court saying, fine by me. So what's the likelihood that the commissioner is going to say, no, what you said, judge, but not fine by me? So how could we ever say that that is harmless error?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, because the court, and you see from the written statement of facts, all that transpired at that December 27 hearing, and it was quite a bit. So the court knew all that. We also know that the Commissioner of Accounts was also very familiar with this case. But in truth, there was more process that they got, really, than you would imagine under any kind of a scenario, because they had both the trial court considering and rejecting the same objections and the Commissioner of Accounts doing the same thing. And there's no evidence that the commissioner was influenced in any way by what the court said, because if the Commissioner of Accounts had not approved the accountings, we wouldn't be here, because then it would not have been an approval by the trial court. The matter would have ended up back in the trial court by the way that the language of the order was drafted.
Justice Goodman has
I've got one question. I just
yes,
want to clear it up. It seems like their complaint is that they never had the opportunity to have a hearing where they could cross-examine the person who served
yes.
as the trustee. Are they entitled to that?
No.
Okay.
No, they are not entitled to that as a matter of law. And that is the only relief that is requested, is remand for a hearing. They have not cited to a statute that requires it. There is absolutely no authority cited for it. It is an option if you get back to the trial court, but it is not as a matter of law. The trial court can just simply confirm under 1212B, can confirm the Commissioner of Accounts report as is. So they do not have a right to a hearing.
Okay. All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.